Accession number 18802, reel 25.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 25. I was asking you whether you regarded television and radio journalists in a different light.
Not really, because I think their interests are different on the whole. But having said that, I don't recollect doing a single television interview during my time in Londonderry, and I did only one radio interview. And so, to that extent, I was spared any particular problems. But I saw them around, and I think some of the pictures from television in particular have not helped to dampen the situation when there have been a problem. But, I understand why they do it. It's not necessarily helpful to the peacemaker.
They mentioned John Hume. Did you get onto terms with any other local politicians besides him? He was the MP, wasn't he?
He was the
SDLP MP.
Yes. He wasn't an MP when I first met him. Mm. He was just the local... Well, he was the local man that everybody turned to. Don't think he was an MP.
Was he a councillor at that time?
No, because the council had been abolished.
The council had been abolished, yes.
But he was a name. And he was the person all the local bogsiders turned to when they had a problem. And he is a very dedicated man. I mean, and I think what he's done over the years is to be admired. Now, how much trouble he's caused as well, I haven't the faintest notion.
Another institution which is very important in Northern Ireland affairs is the church. Did you have any contacts with the local church?
Not really. I mean, I met the bishop just once.
Of course, you had more than one bishop.
We had more than one bishop
in your brigade area.
Indeed. Well, I met various bishops, but only once. Mm. I met various more senior people, but only just in passing. Mm. I can remember we had one road accident in the bogside when an army lorry had run over a small boy who was killed. And I wanted to do something about this, and so I took advice. And the brigade Roman Catholic padre offered to go and talk to the family. And I said, well, look, please express my sorrow and condolences and so on. I would like to write them a letter if they would receive such a letter. And I'd like you to sort of help as much as you can with the family. And they did receive a letter. And, they were very friendly about it all and quite contrary to what one might have expected with a local Catholic family whose child had been run over by the enemy. But all that really disappeared after internment. Any friendly relationships disappeared.
Was there a significant difference between the behaviour of people in the bogside and those in the Cregan? Could you distinguish between them as bodies of people you had to deal with?
Whether people who patrolled the areas generally would be able to say, oh yes, he's one, he's the other, I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, speaking more generally about the city, I would group them together as being the potential problem, the potential troublemakers, and sometimes more than potential. But you see, again, it's quite interesting because as time went on, in 1970, initially, when there were riots, as there were, it took some time to quell them. In 1971, I think it was when the apprentice boys had been marching, and it was before the IRA had really sort of got a hold. And there was an occasion when it was possible for a battalion actually to go into the Bogside, which is a thing we'd been avoiding doing as much as we possibly could, but in pursuit, as it were, of troublemakers, a battalion went in and was accepted by the locals, provided it didn't stay too long. And if it stayed more than, say, half an hour, well, then everything turned against it again. But we were able to do that a couple of times, I can remember, really just to try and tidy up a very untidy situation. But it changed daily.
You mentioned quelling riots. What sort of drills were you using to deal with riots? Were you using the old box formation, or...?
I can remember we did form up in the old box formation once. And everybody looked terribly surprised. No, it was, when I say controlling riots, they're not riots as such. They're people surging to and fro, throwing stones and bottles and things. I mean, technically they're riots, but not quite in the sense of the box formation. No, we put down sort of lines, markers, whatever you like to call them, snatch squads to try and pick up the ringleaders. And sometimes we were successful, more often we probably weren't. And things just blew themselves out. The problem was when buildings were set on fire and the fire engines couldn't get through, then it became rather more of a problem.
What could you do then? Could you clear an
yes,
area?
Yes, you had to.
How would you do that? By baton charging, or...?
Yeah.
Were you using CS at all?
Yes, and eventually rubber bullets, which we hadn't had before. But I mean, personally, I think CS is a mixed blessing, because it blows back on yourself apart from anything else. And it lingers for an awful long time, and it's extremely unpopular. But sometimes it is the only solution.
Do you think CS is... I mean, it was eventually prohibited. Do you think that was a sensible thing to do, to withdraw CS?
I don't think I can answer that question. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was a useful weapon in the armoury. The rights and wrongs of withdrawing it, I don't know.
Once you'd given up the box, why did you give up the box? Because you said you used it only once. What was the reason for abandoning that particular type of formation?
I think because we thought it wasn't going to get anywhere. It wasn't going to achieve what we were trying to achieve. And I honestly can't remember if we did it in my time or if they'd done it just before I got there. But I know it was tried once as a sop to the system.
So what happened when the box was given up? How did you then deal with these surges of people?
Oh, a much more flexible response. As I say, you know, ringing round with a ring of soldiers and then perhaps putting a line over there and then snatch squads going in from that sort of base.
So cordoning.
Yes, yeah.
How close to your cordon would the people actually get normally if they were contesting control of an area? Would they come right up to within arm's length of the troops, or would they stay further back?
A bit of both. And this, of course, is one of the difficulties, and it appeared on television, because you saw soldiers behind these great shields.
Yes.
Now, in fact, we didn't have these great shields initially, but you saw on television soldiers literally standing there with things being pelted at them from a few feet. Now, that's, I don't think, good for trade. But on the other hand, if you have a limited number of soldiers, and if you want to be not too aggressive in your reactions, there's an extent to which you have just to stand and take it. And then, having given time for the opposition to sort of melt away and stop doing what they're doing and come under control of their local stewards or whatever, then you have to react and you send out your SNAT squads. It's a very difficult balance.
Were you seized of the idea that riots could be used as a cover for the deployment of snipers by the other side?
Eventually, yes, we did become aware of that. We hadn't, we didn't experience it to start with.
So it wasn't a thought ab initio from the beginning?
No. I mean, I say no. I mean, I suppose in the back of one's mind it was a possibility, but there was no evidence of it.
Did you have your own marksmen deployed as a countermove against such forms of attack from the beginning, or did that, was that something that developed later on with the threat?
I think that's something that developed later on and would be very much a matter for the local battalion commander.
Not a brigade decision?
Not a brigade decision.
Did you allow battalion commanders then flexibility in what they did in their tactical employment?
Yes, some. Yes, I mean tactical flexibility within a general operational directive. Yes.
Did you find your operational directive remain fairly constant, or was it something that had to be changed?
Fairly constant. But of course, it was conceived in a situation which was broadly peaceful, and certainly without the bullet and the bomb. Once the bullet and the bomb appeared, then things changed.
You mentioned that the first use of a firearm in July 1971 and then internment in August. Had internment been considered in advance? Had it been discussed as a possible course of action?
Don't think so. It was a very hush-hush subject, of course. And when it was first produced, I seem to remember it was produced without consultation. Various lists were produced, which I was absolutely horrified by because they were years out of date. I mean, literally years out of date. And I think several of us protested and said, you know, this is not going to work.
To whom did you make your protest? Would this be the Commander Land Forces?
Yes. But I don't think they were very strong protests because it was quite clear they wanted to go ahead and do this. But I think we probably gave warning saying that, you know, we're not very happy about this. And we're not happy that it's going to be productive. And in fact, as it turned out, it was counterproductive.
When you say we, who do you mean by we? Was it the other brigade commanders?
Yes.
Were all three brigades of a similar opinion about the likely effects of internment?
I think so. I think mainly because we didn't know enough about it, and we didn't know what was going. We didn't know what the lists were based on, and so on, because they came all came straight from the police.
Ah.
And they were, as I say, they were miles out of date. Now we managed to get them adjusted a little bit in the last 24 hours before it all happened. The actual operation itself was extremely well conducted. I mean,
The
lifting process was very efficiently done indeed. I mean, I can only speak for my own area, but it was very well done indeed. But the results, I think, were sad.
How much warning did you have of this operation to lift?
I think about 48 hours, from memory.
Where did the orders come from? Were they from HQ Northern Ireland?
Yes.
This came out from Lisburn.
Yes.
And the source of the information was the RUC.
Yes. And, I mean, when the orders came down, I mean, we were given lists. By that time, of course, the county system of RUC had disappeared, and we were all on a divisional basis.
Yes.
And we got a list from, I mean, I had five divisions, I think, at that particular time. And, you know, Division P, so-and-so names, Division O, I mean, X number of names in each division. And so a plan had to be made to lift those various people.
Who did the planning for that? Was it your brigade staff, or was it done by battalions?
Done by battalions. alongside the local police.
Yeah. How were these operations actually carried out then, these arrests?
Well, a little group of four men or whatever arrived in a Land Rover or an armoured car or something and said, "You're nicked," and words to that effect. And then carted them off back to an interrogation centre.
Where was that? Was that a central one in Belfast, or were they their local interrogation centres?
I think there were local. Certainly, there was one in Belfast at Castlereagh, or wherever it was.
Tin City.
Yes, I think. I honestly can't remember whether all the my brigade lot came to Londonderry or whether some of them went to Omagh. I can't remember.
What happened to them? Were they actually interrogated or were they just locked up?
Well, they were. I suppose they were put in captivity. Well, they obviously all couldn't be interrogated simultaneously, but they were cleared as quickly as possible. Some went off to further imprisonment, and some, if I remember, were released.
Had your soldiers by that time already begun making arrests? You mentioned using snatch squads. Presumably when they managed to catch a ringleader, they would arrest them.
Oh, yes.
What would happen to them after they'd been arrested by a snatch squad?
Handed over to the police. And, you know, processed in the normal way from there.
And you were saying that after internment everything went sour. What were the consequences, the immediate and medium-term consequences in your area?
Well, I think you used a phrase earlier on that, you know, having been saviours, the army suddenly became the enemy. Mm. Well, it became more so. And whenever people thereafter appeared in a local nationalist area to do anything, people beat their dustbin lids to sort of give warning to everybody else that we were around, even if we weren't going to do anything in particular. We had been working very hard to get the RUC unarmed back into walking through the bogside just on an ordinary beat duty. We had succeeded in doing that. All of that went for a complete burden, everything. I mean, the RUC became fully armed from that minute onwards, et cetera, everything we had been trying to work for towards, let's call it normality, some sort of normality, just disappeared. And it was very sad.
How did you actually change your own activities to respond to the change? What had to be done to...
Well, I'm still back to the problem that, you know, I'm being told that the IRA is doing this, the IRA is doing that, you must beat them up or do whatever. But every time I said, evidence, please, to the commanding officers and the local police, I said, please, tell me where they are so that I can do something about it. And nobody could. And right up to the moment I left, I still had no actual information on which to, let's call it, attack the IRA, which is very sad. Having said that, we got to the stage, a ridiculous stage in Londonderry, where we had a little garrison in the middle of the bogside, which had to be resupplied every so often. And we had to mount an actual operation to resupply it and sort of remove barricades in order to get there and so on, which is a ridiculous situation. But that had occurred sort of slowly over the months, which is why I say Londonderry was worse when I left it than when I went there. But the only way we were going to dispose of that, well, there are two ways of doing it. One was something like Motorman, as it turned out in 1972. Or, as I had tried to do, and I'd talked to Lord Carrington about, who was Secretary of State of Defence at the time, and to Northern Ireland headquarters, I wanted to do a sneaky operation, which was overnight to put in enough soldiers to occupy the whole of Londonderry, and to make it quite clear that we were not just doing the bogside and the cricket, but that we were occupying the Protestant bit of Londonderry as well. So it was completely impartial. And when I say occupy, I mean it would be fairly thinly occupied, but enough to be able to hold a number of different camps round about the place and to patrol fairly vigorously within the whole city area.
How many men would that have required, do you think?
24 companies.
Intensive patrol, 24 companies?
24 companies, that would be, which is what I asked for in order to do this exercise.
About 6 battalions,
yes.
Wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And indeed, the there have been arrangements for reinforcement,
yes,
of Northern Ireland. And so you and I put in my bid for my lot, my bit. But unfortunately, they regarded the border as more important. And so the reinforcement went to the border and not to me. And I said, I cannot do this operation at half cock. It's got to be the whole thing. Mm. And I cannot do the Catholic area only. It must be the whole of Londonderry. And it never happened. And the result was that Londonderry got worse and worse.
What view did Lord Carrington take of your proposal?
He was quite interested. But he's a very skilled politician, a very skilled diplomat. And I think he's accustomed to, and I know him quite well now from my later jobs, I think he's accustomed to whoever he's talked to last, feeling that, you know, they're the people who've had the complete attention, which is a great skill to be able to do that. But on the face of it, he was impressed with the thoughts, on the face of it, but it did require a huge number of soldiers.
Was that his only visit, or did you see him more than once?
I think that's the only time I saw him in that particular job.
Mm. What about other...
you see, when I first went to Londonderry, there was a Labour government. And
yes.
I can remember Roy Hattersley coming as a Minister of Defence.
Yes.
And I may have... No, I don't think I did mention. He was very good with the soldiers, very good indeed. I took him around quite a lot of Londonderry. And much to his surprise, I think, because it can't be too often that brigade commanders say to a visiting minister, look, please come back again, but come and stay the night next time so that you can see what happens at night, because that's much more interesting than seeing soldiers by day just resting as they're now doing. And he was interested enough to say, well, you know, I might, but then, of course, they got thrown out, and that was in early 1970 when I said all that. But, no, Carrington was very receptive, but... you know, either he or Northern Ireland headquarters couldn't produce the soldiers, and so it never happened.
Do you think that sort of saturation patrolling would have been effective?
Yes, I do.
How long would you have had to keep it up to impose a...
I don't know. Mm. We never produced a timetable for it.
Mm.
But, you know, if people want to do something badly enough, they will produce the resources to do it.
Mm.
If you don't do it, well, you lose control of whatever.
Why do you think they were more interested in reinforcing the border? Were they expecting incursions from
the
Republic?
I mean, I don't know. I suppose.
Because just south of London, you have got Strabane, haven't you?
Yes.
Which is an area which was renowned for...
Very nasty area indeed.
...the passage of
yes.
armed bands back
yes.
and forwards.
Very nasty.
Was any of that going on when you were commanding the brigade?
I think probably, but I don't know it for a fact. Mm. Certainly, Strabane was one of the places I didn't like driving through.
Mm. Where was your headquarters? Where did you actually live and work while you were there?
In Everington Barracks, mm. which had been HMS Sea Eagle. Mm. And we set up an ops room there, and eventually it became... just about the time I was leaving, it became a joint police-military ops room.
Did you feel that your headquarters at Everington was safe, was a secure place, or was it ever threatened?
It was never threatened as such. I mean, it could have been bombed, I suppose, from the air, but I don't think it could have been done from the land. It was open across the river. I mean, when I was talking
yes.
about standing on the square there, you were exposed across the river, but, you know, most unlikely.
Would have been long range, wouldn't it?
Long range
yes.
shooting, yes,
yes,
most unlikely. No, the time you were most vulnerable, I suppose, was when we had the TAC headquarters in the police station.
Yes.
And that happened fairly regularly.
Looking back on your time in Londonderry as a whole, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think there was anything else you could have done and should have done to have improved matters, to have forestalled the deterioration that you've described? I'm talking about you as a brigade commander, bearing in mind the fact that you were not in control of the world.
Yeah. I've often wondered that. The answer is there must have been, because it shouldn't have gone the way it did go. I can only say that I wasn't conscious of what that solution might have been. I can only say that I did my best according to the information and the situation as I found it. It wasn't good enough. I mean, it's as simple as that, really. And somehow or other, we let it all escape. And we let it come under, in inverted commas, enemy control. Mm. Bits of Londonderry, the other bits of Londonderry, are perfectly all right all the way through. Mm. It's a very difficult question to answer.
On the business of internment, you were saying that it went wrong because the lists were out of date. Do you think that internment might have been an effective and acceptable measure if the people who'd been lifted were genuinely the bad guys, as opposed to being a more random and obsolete list of people?
I think the answer to that must be yes, but I think I'd qualify it by saying it would have to be simultaneous within the South, who apparently are much more ready to look at internment than we are now. I think it ought to be simultaneous, North and South, if it's going to happen at all.
Well, the Republic's always been much more ruthless with its dissidents than the United Kingdom.
Yes.
And whether it's a matter of shooting them or imprisoning them.
But I don't think that internment in the North alone is likely to be successful.
But might it have been back in 1971 if it had been targeted more accurately? Was it a matter of failure of intelligence, or...?
I think it was both, probably. I think, again, it should have been linked up with the South, I think, to be successful. If it had been done with the South and with up-to-date lists, I'm quite sure it would have been successful. Mm. Well, I'm not quite sure. I think it would have been successful.
And there were objections to it on grounds of constitutional and philosophical principle,
yes,
weren't there? Civil
yes.
rights.
Yes.
As well as on grounds of practicality.
Yes, there were. I mean, I'm not in favour of internment, really, as a general proposition. But I would be prepared to look at it in terms of decent, up-to-date intelligence information on the one hand, and joint action with the Republic on the other hand. But not otherwise.
Reflecting what you said earlier on, it does appear that, and certainly at this early stage in Northern Ireland, it was done more on the same basis as you experienced in Aden than on what you'd done in Malaya.
I'm sorry, I haven't got that question.
Thinking about what happened in your period in Northern Ireland, it seems to resemble Aden, your experience in Aden, rather more than your experience in Malaya.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
As far as intelligence goes, at any rate.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Mm. But having said that, I mean, I can't imagine anything being similar to Northern Ireland. I mean, it is utterly different from anything I've ever done in my life before. Mm. And one of the sad things is, you know, one saw people in a state of just deprivation. Mm. And it was interesting, even the youngest soldier looked at them and said, you know, I'm so sorry for these people. I'm sad at what we're required to do, and so on. And I can remember a sentry on the butcher's gate one day, and somebody came up to him and said, oh, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? To which his answer was, I'm black, isn't that enough problem? Which I thought was a rather good answer. You know, these sort of things stick in the mind.
Again, one of the great difficulties with counterinsurgency and counter-revolutionary warfare in general